Missing this?
This is the dream. Shohi on Fringlord. Whether you're from Cushendall in Antrim or Mount Syne in Waterford, this is what it's all about.
And get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free. Ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play. Daniel, we wanted to talk to you about Manchester United and Marcus Rashford and a great piece that you've written about Marcus Rashford, but we may as well start with the White Lives Matter Burnley plane. I was going to call it a protest, but it's not. It's such a weird thing to have happened. I'm kind of at a little bit of a loss to understand exactly where it's coming from, or even like I don't really understand the point of it, to be honest. I guess the point of it is that we're talking about it now.
I mean, I think people felt that they had a point to make, and so they wanted to make the point. And I mean, they did have a point to make. It was the wrong point, a terrible, awful, disgusting point. It was all of those things, but that's why. And one of the things that is so worrying, terrifying, upsetting about this is how many people it needed to go through to get to where it got through. So someone had to have the idea, then they had to discuss it with their mates. You can imagine the awful WhatsApp patter that went around as they decided to do it. People had to pay for it. You had to contact, find a plane company. The plane company had to be prepared to do it. The pilot had to be prepared to do it. Everyone involved had to be prepared to send a far-right racist message over a football match that was on live television at a time of racial tension where black people, people of colour are justifiably still extremely upset. And I think, I don't feel like this is something that white people quite understand, that life for black people, for people of colour, has not just gone back to normal after George Floyd. And I wrote this in the piece that you mentioned, that people, for the last, this month, we've had people of colour who have been losing sleep, who've been not able to work properly, who've been not able to concentrate, who are constantly discussing their own oppression with each other, with other people who are challenging them. It is a phenomenally stressful, painful time. And then you see something like this. And it's really hard to say, well, what do we do about that? Because we don't really even know how many people did it and how we go about educating people who don't want to be educated. But I think ultimately what we see is that British football reflects British society, and British society has racist elements, is structurally racist, has always been structurally racist. And when we look at our cabinet, we see that. When we look at the behaviour of the Prime Minister, we see that. And it's rotten, and it starts at the top and it goes to the bottom, and it starts at the bottom and it goes to the top.
Well, that's why it's important that we talk about Marcus Rashford and what he's managed to achieve over the very short window of the last 5 or 6 weeks. Look, Marcus Rashford's greatness, actually, when you look back at it, and again, I was kind of unaware of some of the stuff that he'd done in the past around homelessness, for example, and you put it all together, it turns out Marcus Rashford has been a really brilliant person essentially all his life. He's kind of cresting to a point of national significance in England at the moment because of what's happened specifically around school lunches over the last while. But his leadership and his willingness to stand up and to be a leader, even though it's much easier not to be, is something that, yeah, it's troubling that we need these people like Marcus Rashford and Raheem Sterling to stand up. But, and yet at the same time, you kind of have to be really proud of the fact that they're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually, I alluded to this in the piece, and I mean, what Rashford's done is amazing, but I think that it's really important to note that in order to be accorded respect and equality and justice, black people don't need to do anything other than to exist. And so it's all very well, anyone can look at what Marcus Rashford has done and say what Marcus Rashford done is incredible. But what we need as a society to do is look at everyone who, of whatever race, colour they are, and say they have a place in our society. They are people who it's worthy of respecting. And Marcus Rashford probably didn't want to tweet about Black Lives Matter, for example. He doesn't want to be a representative of anyone other than himself. But what happens with a minority is that one member of the minority represents everyone. There's a concept in Judaism, has its own concept for this thing that is called Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem, and one means sanctifying God's name and desecrating God's name. But it's not really about God, it's a communal thing that you have to be aware that as a Jewish person, if you do something, it's not just going to reflect on you, that people will judge the community according to what you do. And I feel like that's the same with Rashford, where people might look at him and say, well, look what Marcus Rashford did, but he's a good one or he's a bad one. But it isn't like that. It's that, as Marcus Rashford tweeted himself, Black Lives Matter, Black Cultures Matter, Black Culture Matters, Black Communities Matter, We Matter. And mattering is not any kind of social contract. You don't have to do something nice for society to matter. In order to exist, you just have to exist. And I'm going to I try not to do this very often, but I am going to quote what I wrote in the piece, because I think it's a really important point that since classification was imposed upon them, Black people have rarely been afforded the privilege of defining themselves as individuals, of representing themselves as individuals, of simply being. And I think that is the thing now with Marcus Rashford that we need to get over. Anyone can say that they like Marcus Rashford because he's done these objectively good things. But what we have to do as a society is to recognise that Marcus Rashford is of value, not because he did all these things and not because he's good at football, but because he exists. And that applies to every other single person of whatever denomination. Just by existing, they are of value. And it's mortifying and appalling that we're sitting here of a Tuesday morning having to state this, but it seems that we absolutely have to state it, and we have to keep stating it, and that's part of our responsibility as human beings.
The other kind of central theme to your piece is that we shouldn't be constantly asking for people to share their stories of racism for us to understand that they are suffering racism on a constant basis. And I totally understand that, and I've seen many commentators say that they're tired of sharing their stories of being racially abused, and even I think Emma Dabry referred to it as titillation, you know, because there's been a series of stuff in Irish radio in particular over the last fortnight where people have been sharing their stories of being racially abused. And the front page of The Sun this morning has Darren Randolph, the West Ham goalkeeper, talking about being racially abused and how it was actually just a normal thing for him as a child growing up in Wicklow. I understand that. I also feel like there has to come a tipping point where an awareness level is reached so that you can never just go back and say, well, this is something that is okay, and we live in a post-racist society, or any of the stuff that we kind of took for granted over the last decade or so as we filtered this into an accommodated existence where we kind of felt like everything might not be perfect, but like at least we're trending in the right direction. Whereas now we're clearly not trending in the right direction. Like we've reached a point where things are getting worse. And unless we deal with these on an ongoing basis, we might not actually ever get to deal with them properly.
No, I mean, it's an urgent conversation. It was an urgent conversation a long time ago, but it appears that we're now having the conversation at least. And there is a long way to go, because prejudice is ingrained, and people who are prejudiced, some people who are prejudiced don't even know that they're prejudiced or the extent of their prejudice. And I think the thing that people need to understand is that the extent of the racism that is endemic within our society, we don't understand it. We don't understand the extent of it. And as I wrote in the piece, I have a handle on this because I'm married to a British Ghanaian. So one half of my family has these stories. But I was chatting to my brother-in-law the other day, and the quantity of stories of encounters with teachers and police and just general people that he has from his youth is, I mean, I don't have the words to describe how staggering it is, the quantity of them and the brazenness of it. And that was some time ago, but then I have another brother-in-law who's a further 10 years younger, and I have a wife who goes out into the world and goes out into employment. And the things that people say that they think are acceptable are staggering. And these are people who've grown up in what you might call more middle class environments where people are meant to know better. And people don't know better. And I look at myself, and so we've been together for 12 years. I'm a Jew, and a lot of my family died in the Holocaust, so I have a handle on discrimination. But nevertheless, 12 years on, I'm still learning. And let me give another example, I suppose, where, okay, we have a daughter. So my daughter is the thing in the world that is most mine. So I feel that I have some level of ownership and input into my daughter's childhood, into my daughter's life, as a normal father. However, despite my 12 years of experience with my wife, and despite my personal experience as grandson of a Holocaust survivor, as someone who's experienced discrimination as a Jew, when we have a racial question that comes up with my daughter, and again, in similar vein, these come up a lot more often than anyone who doesn't have them coming up in their life would think, and a lot more often than we would want. When we have a question on that issue, despite all the things that I might think I have to bring to that issue, and as you know, I'm not shy, I'm not behind the door in stating an opinion when I have one, but when things come up with regard to that issue, I do not state my opinion. I say to my wife, we're in this situation, or she says to me, we've got this situation, and then I say, what should we do? And she says, this is what we're going to do. I might ask for clarification so I understand better. But what I never, ever, ever do is say, but I think this. Because what I think about this does not matter. I don't experience it. I don't experience that kind of racism. I see it happening. It makes me furious. It makes me devastated. And I experience seeing the people who are closest to me hurt by it. But I don't experience it. And therefore, I don't have the right or the authority to give opinions about it, ever. Even when it concerns my daughter, which is the thing, as I said, that is most mine in the whole world. And I think that is another thing that we need to understand, that society needs to understand. There are a lot of people that are used not only to having what they think is an opinion about something, but to having the right opinion about something, and they prove that it's the right opinion about something because that's what people end up doing. But people have to divorce themselves from that, and they have to sit down and they have to listen, and listen to people supplying the answers. You wouldn't ask me what it is like to be me, because obviously only I know the answer to that, and even I would struggle to describe that to you. And similarly, when there is something that only affects someone, then you need to listen to that person to understand what it is and do what that person says that you should do to alleviate the situation. And that's what we need to do in this circumstance. We need to listen to the people that experience the situation, that understand it, that know how it feels. And there we will find the answers about how to educate ourselves and what to do to make society better and to make society just and fair and to make society work.
Yeah. And look, I think that that's a little bit of the thing that people are grappling with. There's an exhaustion on the part of people of colour telling their story because it feels like they've been telling the same story for such a long period of time. And at the same time, there's an audience that needs to hear this. And it's finding a safe space or a safe way for that communication to happen. I wonder, like, in the midst of all this turmoil, is there any room for a little bit of hope that these conversations are finally happening?
I think so. I mean, as long as we don't get complacent that we're anywhere near finding a solution, because we don't really even know what the solution is yet, never mind having implemented a solution. But there does seem to have been some kind of change where people are trying to learn, people are trying to do better. So we're definitely not in a position to start congratulating ourselves, but we're at least having the conversation. And it's devastating what had to happen for that conversation to be one that we're having. But the fact that we are having it is an improvement, and I guess we'll see where we take it before we start making any judgments. But it's not something we can start affecting immediate change immediately by talking to the people who are in our immediate sphere of influence. But the long-lasting social change is going to take years and decades and generations. But every journey starts with a small step, and I think that we have to there's an obligation on all of us to try and be part of the solution. It's not incumbent upon us to solve the problem, but neither are we free from attempting to solve that problem.
Yeah, I think that, and look, that goes back to Marcus Rashford standing up. It would be great to see a bunch of other people who play football standing up who aren't people of colour. So the ones who have it really easy, who've had it really easy to get to the point where, you know, they're middle class and they're now full-time Premier League footballers. I'd love to hear from them going, actually, you know what, this has been quite an eye-opening experience for me. And I too have a platform and I'm going to use that platform to help people. Because there has been this kind of view that footballers, you know, they don't always come from a very well-educated place. And why are we asking them to be responsible for changing social opinion? But actually, it does really feel like you kind of either stand for something or you don't. And if you're just there to make money and whatever it is, and that's who you are, that's fine. But like, don't sell us shoes and don't try and influence us to buy whatever it is the new computer game is that you're trying to sell. People need to stand for something at the moment.
I mean, when we saw that Ben Mee spoke so brilliantly last night, and I think that one of the things I mentioned in that piece was that when Raheem Sterling was being attacked by the British press, none of his teammates said anything. Gareth Southgate didn't really say very much. Manchester City didn't say anything. What they could have done was they could have banned the papers that were attacking him. They could have banned the Daily Mail, the Mail and the Express. They could have banned them. They could have refused to give interviews to those journalists. The teammates could have spoken up, but no one did anything. And I agree with that now the time has come, as we said earlier, it's not for black people to educate us about racism. It's for people to acknowledge that racism exists. If people that experience it are talking to us, then we have to listen. But otherwise, there is so much reading out there. In the news recently, René Adeoloji's book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, that is top of the bestsellers in England. And it's top of the bestsellers in America. Lots of people will be aware of that. That book will, if you read that book and you come out of it still a racist, then you are probably irredeemable. Read that book. There is so much scholarship, so many newspaper articles, so many books available, and the internet is available to most of us too. So we have all these things available, and it's for those of us who are aware of it to try and educate people within our sphere of influence, and for people to take it upon themselves to solve problems in the way that they take it upon themselves to solve all the other problems in their lives. If people that experience racism want to talk to us about it, then we listen, but we don't require them, and it is not their duty to. And as you say, it would be nice to see some public solidarity from people with a platform, particularly when it's just a matter of supporting your mates, which you should be doing as a mate as well as a human being.
Yeah, no, totally. Look, we were supposed to talk about football. We were supposed to talk about the absence of crowds and how it might be good for Manchester City, but we got rightfully sidetracked by the big story of the day. One last thing about how Manchester United are doing at the moment as an avowed Manchester United fan. What's your level of positivity towards how things are going?
I thought they played quite well against Spurs. They should have won the game based on the number of chances they created relative to what Spurs created, but Spurs was by far the hardest game that they had left. And when you're 1-0 down with less than 10 minutes to go, a draw is obviously a decent result. I would expect United to step it up from here because I feel like it's become quite clear what United's best team is now as well. But Paul Pogba obviously might be problematic if you've got Pogba and Fernandes against a good team because they're both high-risk, high-reward players, which means you end up giving the ball away quite a lot. If you're playing Manchester City, you won't see it again for a while. But against the teams that United should be beating, if you've got a midfield of Pogba and Fernandes, then you would expect to create enough chances to win. And similarly, Daniel James played against Tottenham because he's good against better teams when there's space to run into. The way it turned out was Spurs sat deep, so Daniel James wasn't that helpful, and United got better when Mason Greenwood came on. I would expect to see Mason Greenwood take his place against Sheffield United tomorrow night, and it looks quite a lot like, with Pogba and Greenwood in, that would be United's best front six. And they should have enough to win every game that they've got. It's unlikely that they will. But then Chelsea have to play Manchester City and Liverpool, so it's unlikely that Chelsea will either. So it looks like it's two from United, Chelsea and Wolves. And from United's fixtures, it looks like they should have enough to finish in the top five, which should probably be enough for the Champions League. So I think that as they get fitter, they will obviously get better. But there were good signs against Spurs that the good form that we saw before the break is something that will continue, I think.
One last question. How has your recovery from COVID been? Because there's been stories here of people actually being completely wiped out months and months after they get it.
I would say physically, I'm probably not quite where I was before it, but I don't know if that is also, I mean, been sitting in a house eating and drinking for quite as long as I have. So it might be that. I had an antibody test, and for people that have antibodies, 0.4 is the average. And I was 6.06, which is more than 15 times what the average antibodies is. So it's fair to say that I definitely had it. And during the time when I had it, because I didn't have that many of the telltale signs, I was sort of beginning to wonder whether I did actually have it. But otherwise, I feel quite lucky that I had it and it wasn't so physically terrible as it has been for other people. And ultimately, as I said at the time, but the main thing for me about Corona was mentally how tough it is when you wake up in the night and you're thinking it's today the day it all turns to shit. And that didn't happen. So I guess I feel quite lucky that that didn't happen to me, because it's still happening to a lot of other people.
Well, look, I'm glad it didn't. It's great to chat to you again, and stay well. Thanks a million.
See you again, chaps. Look after yourself. Bye.
The OTB Podcast Network.